Hey, good morning, everybody. It is 10 o'clock, and our time being pretty limited, I need to go ahead and get started. We're in Judges chapter 14. We've been studying about Samson. And we've made it up to verse 10. All right, so we saw Samson's desire to marry a Philistine woman from the city of Timnah. So we just refer to her as the Timnite woman. And we spent quite a bit of Thursday kind of talking about this divide in motives. All right, so Samson is God's appointed instrument for delivering Israel from Philistine oppression. And one of the big questions that we've had is how on board with this is Samson? So kind of the operative statement of this whole part of the story, right after Samson expresses his desire to marry this Philistine woman, his parents object to it, but we learn in verse 4, his father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. And so there was this question, whenever we say that he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines, is it the Lord who's looking for an opportunity? Is it Samson who's looking for an opportunity? Is Samson aware of what the Lord is doing through him? And over the course of our reading, at least on Thursday, it appears to us that Samson himself seems to be moved by other motives. So at the end of verse 3, for example, we learn his motive for marrying this Timnite woman. Right? Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes." We said that's going to become an important phrase for the end of the book of Judges, where we're going to learn eventually that because there's no king in Israel, everybody is doing what is right in their own eyes. And this is the first example of it here, Samson going after this foreign bride. We get another example later on, whenever Samson, for some reason, is in a vineyard, which is not, we'll just say it's not prudent for a Nazarite to be in a vineyard. Because remember, Nazarites are not supposed to have anything to do with grapes. While he is there, he's attacked by a lion, and the Spirit of the Lord rushes on him so that he rips this lion in pieces with his bare hands. But then he comes back later, and the carcass of this lion is now host to a swarm of bees and is full of honey. And this is something that Rena pointed out on Thursday, that the lion is an unclean animal. And I hadn't even thought to look it up, because what's going on is already unclean by reason of it being a carcass, right? It could be the carcass of anything. It being a dead body makes it unclean. And he just scrapes this honey out of this carcass and eats it. Well, it turns out it's doubly bad, because he's scraping the honey out of the carcass of an unclean animal. And he eats this honey. He apparently does not care about his Nazarite vow. We'll read later on in his story, by the way, you know, what he thinks his Nazarite status means. We'll see that in the way that he talks to Delilah. We have already seen, though, the angel of the Lord has given Manoah and his wife, so he's given Samson's parents, a clear picture of what that Nazarite status means. He's specific, right, that Manoah's wife and that Samson are not supposed to have anything that comes from the vine, no wine or strong drink, no unclean thing. In fact, he specifies that. Do not eat any unclean thing. He specifies that at least twice over the course of chapter 13. So, and besides the bit with the hair growing out. Samson's parents, at least, have a fairly accurate understanding of what Samson's Nazirite status is supposed to entail. So what's going on here? Have they failed to pass it down to Samson? Or does Samson just not care? For whatever reason, Samson, while he's in this vineyard, scrapes this honey out and eats it. It is a violation of his Nazirite status. And what the law tells us is that he ought to go and offer an atoning sacrifice. He ought to have his head shaved, and he ought to be reconsecrated as a Nazirite. We never read of him doing any of those things. So that begins to give us this sense of Samson's motives being separate from God's motives. And we'll see if that continues to hold true through the Samson story. But at this point, we think it would be useful to be reading the story at those two levels. That you can recognize, all right, here's Samson's motive on the one hand, which might be different from what God is doing with the same events, the same activities. The Lord has his intent, his motives. Samson's motives are often quite different from the Lord's. Wayne, I saw your hand.
Okay. Refresh my memory. Samson was born a Nazirite.
Yeah, he's a Nazirite from the womb. Which, so it wasn't just him who had to hold these dietary restrictions. His mother also had to while she was bearing him.
So there is no, he can't be reconsecrated because he has been consecrated for.
Yeah, he has.
Where?
In chapter 13.
Okay.
The angel says he's a Nazirite to the Lord from the womb. That's the consecration right there.
That was the consecration. That stands for you.
Right. Again, we've got to remember that Samson's Nazirite status is different from the norm because it's not a voluntary vow. The angel of the Lord, the Lord has picked for him, has assigned to him that he is to be a Nazirite from the womb. So things, the operating of it looks a little bit different in that regard, but the rules are the same. In fact, that's the whole point of the angel of the Lord saying that he is a Nazirite, is it can refer us back to those standards. Yeah. Right. Samson's still got to do this to maintain his Nazirite status. At this point, and this is something that Kathleen pointed out on Thursday, at this point, strictly speaking, we really can't say that he's still a Nazirite, although we are going to see God continue to bless him. The Spirit of the Lord is going to continue to come on him, and we'll see what Samson thinks about himself later on once we meet Delilah. He still thinks he, I'll just spoil it for you, he still thinks he's a Nazirite. Go ahead. That's the whole point. This is all happening not on account of Samson's righteousness or his adherence to his Nazirite status. It is happening because the Lord chooses for it to happen. That's exactly the point. All right, so let's jump into verse 10. His father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast there, for so the young men used to do. As soon as the people saw him, they brought him 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, "Let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. But if you cannot tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes." And they said to him, put your riddle that we may hear it. And he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. And in 3 days they could not solve the riddle. On the fourth day, and we'll, if you're reading, say, like the King James or the New King James, it'll say seventh day. We'll talk about that in a second. On the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband to tell us what the riddle is, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us here to impoverish us? And Samson's wife wept over him and said, you only hate me. You do not love me. You've put a riddle to my people, and you've not told me what it is. And he said to her, behold, I have not told my father nor my mother. Shall I tell you? She wept before him the 7 days their feast lasted, and on the seventh day he told her, because she pressed him hard. Then she told the riddle to her people. And the men of the city said to him on the seventh day, before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion? And he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town and took their spoil and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house, and Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. All right, so chapter 14 ends with the wedding feast of Samson, just dominated with this riddle contest. The narrator tells us that things are done according to custom. There's a week-long feast. And the word for feast here, in English, we think of feast, like we associate that mainly with food, right? Feasting is about food. The Hebrew word for feast that's used here comes from the Hebrew word meaning to drink, right? So in the way it's framed here, the feasting is associated mainly with drinking. Right, we think of a feast as a lot of food. They think of a feast as a lot to drink. Which certainly fits the context, because what did we just learn earlier in the chapter about the land around Timnah? What does Timnah have attached to it? Vineyards. It fits the context. And again, we're left wondering, wait a minute, what's Samson doing here? We're never told explicitly that he himself engages in any kind of drinking. Just like we're not told explicitly that while he's hanging out in the vineyard earlier, he eats any of the grapes or anything. It's just, we'll just say it's not a good look for him. Because this word in particular is pretty regularly used to refer to drinking bouts. All right, so again, maybe Samson is abstaining from this feast that he himself is preparing. We learn that he's the active agent there in verse 10. Samson prepared the feast there. Perhaps he's not partaking, but we don't know. Sorry, what was that? Oh, okay. We can be charitable with Samson. Although, again, we don't necessarily have a whole lot of reason to be, because we've already seen him pretty flagrantly ignore his Nazirite status, eating the honey out of the lion's carcass. So now, perhaps also according to Philistine custom, the people of Timnah take 30 men to be Samson's companions, his wedding party. We don't really know what this custom's about. We don't know if these men are essentially meant to be guards to keep watch over the groom. It's pretty typical through history. If this is meant to foster some kind of friendship between the bride's people and between the groom and the groom's family, that attempt fails spectacularly, because Samson poses a riddle to them and wagers 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes on whether or not they can answer by the end of the wedding feast. It's a huge wager. Remember how expensive clothing is in antiquity. And the riddle, of course, is unfair. It's not meant to be solved. because it refers to something that only Samson knows about. It's kind of like if you've ever read The Hobbit, and you know, you're familiar with Bilbo and Gollum's riddle game. Bilbo doesn't mean to tell his final riddle, you know, what's in my pocket, but it's obviously unfair, right? Because that's not really a riddle. It's just like, it's something that only Bilbo knows. Same thing here with Samson. It refers to a situation that only he knows about, and the text has been really specific about this, that he doesn't tell anybody about it. He's not told his own father or mother about it. Only he knows about it, and now he's going to use it as his kind of his ace in the hole to pose a riddle and get himself 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. Wayne, I saw your hand.
I'm just thinking, is there some special reason why for the 30?
Well, because there's 30 companions.
Well,
so one from each of them.
I'm saying that 30 equals how many days of the month, so each one of the
months. Yeah, I don't know if there's any significance to why the people of Timnah picked 30 companions. There might be something to it that we just don't know. This whole situation, though, this is kind of a heads I win, tails you lose situation. And so we're told that at the end of 3 days, the 30 companions are unable to solve the riddle. Now, it's not entirely clear at what point the companions come to the Timnite woman. So again, as we were reading through the ESV in verse 15, and if you're reading, I think that probably the New American Standard and the American Standard, probably the NIV, all going to say the fourth day. Okay, and what are you reading from?
American Standard.
American Standard, and it says fourth?
Yeah.
Okay. King James and probably the New King James will say seventh day. What's going on here is that... The ESV, ASV, NIV, etc., they're following what the Old Greek and Syriac versions of the text say. The King James and the New King James are keeping with the Masoretic text. And adding to the uncertainty about when these guys actually come and talk to her, that the text tells us that the Timnite woman wept before Samson the entire 7 days of the feast. Which just, I don't know, it seems like an odd way to express things regardless of when these guys come, whether it's the fourth day or the seventh day. The essential thing here is that the companions come to the Timnite woman and they extort her to provide an answer to the riddle. They threaten to burn down her and her father's house, that is her whole family. All right, we're going to murder all of you if you don't provide us the answer to this riddle. It's not the first time that we've heard this kind of threat, by the way. Right, the Ephraimites made the same threat to Jephthah back in chapter 12. But keep this threat in the backs of your minds because we're going to see it come up again shortly in the text. But the Timnite woman's only way out is to trick or seduce her husband into telling her the answer to the riddle. So then pay attention to the last thing that they say to her. Have you invited us here to impoverish us? At the end of verse 15. The word for impoverish is dispossess. It's the exact same Hebrew word that we saw all over the book of Joshua. It means to take possession of or to inherit. It's the whole, remember, the whole process of the conquest is that God is dispossessing the pagans from in front of Israel so that they can come into their possession, that they can come into their inheritance. And remember, that's all the same Hebrew word. It is the key word of the conquest. Israel is supposed to dispossess the nation so that they can come into their inheritance. And so you've got this nice piece of dramatic irony here. Because the Philistines have no idea how close they've come to the mark with what they say to the Timnite woman. Because really, that's the whole point of all of this. That God is going to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And the reason they need delivering is because Israel had failed to thoroughly dispossess the Philistines to begin with. And so part of what God is doing is he's working to finish that for them. So again, these guys are pretty close to the mark without having any idea how close to the mark they are when they ask, have you invited us here to impoverish or to dispossess us? But yes, that's actually exactly why they're invited there. They don't know it. The Timnite woman doesn't know it. Odds are Samson doesn't know it. So the Timnite woman comes to Samson and she resorts to manipulation, just as the companions did. Right, you only hate me. You don't love me. And she pretty obviously asks for the answer to the riddle. Like she's not trying to hide her intentions from Samson here. We'll notice this come up again, by the way, once we get to Delilah. Right? Like this woman is not subtle. Delilah is not subtle. Like anybody with two brain cells to rub together can figure out, okay, this woman's asking me this. There's really only one reason why she's asking me this. And it's completely obvious later on where the answer comes from. Whenever the companions are able to answer the riddle, there's only one source that it could have come from. So at first, Samson resists. But she spends the rest of the wedding feast crying in front of him. And eventually he breaks down on the last day of the feast and tells her the answer. So, the companions have the answer. They wait until the last moment to bring the answer before Samson. And so the Philistines now have seemingly, at least they think, won out over Samson. But Samson, of course, recognizes the source of his loss, right? If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. That's just as offensive in Hebrew as it is in English, by the way, for Samson to be calling his wife or soon-to-be wife the heifer. But here, we begin to see the Lord's plan come to fruition. As the Spirit of the Lord rushes on Samson again, and he goes down to the Philistine city of Ashkelon, and he kills 30 men of the Philistines, strips them of their garments, and delivers those garments to the 30 companions as payment for the wager. But then finally, enraged by this whole affair, Samson leaves his wife in Timnah and returns to his home in Zorah. All right, so again, we can see some split motives going on here. Right, the Lord is working through Samson, but what's really motivating Samson himself, right, as far as he's concerned? Does he see this as, all right, this is part of my righteous holy war against the Philistines on the part of Israel? That's not really what comes across at the end of the text. At the end of verse 19, we read, in hot anger, he went back to his father's house. All right, what's motivating Samson in all of this is rage and a desire for revenge. We're going to see that continue in Samson's story, by the way. So again, the Lord is doing one thing through Samson. Samson thinks he's doing another thing. Now, the text continues to refer to the Timnite woman as Samson's wife. I think it's important for us to hold on to that. As far as the narrator is concerned, they are married. And we're going to see that continue into the next chapter. But remember also that in antiquity, divorce is often a matter of just leaving your spouse or sending them away. In a lot of ancient cultures, there's no formal process for initiating or finalizing a divorce. In antiquity, in a lot of cultures, it was really simple, right? A guy like physically leaves his wife, as in just walks away and doesn't come back. It's a divorce, right? The guy tells his wife, you may go. He sends her out. Yes, in the law, All right, so again, we're talking about Philistine culture here. Yeah, in a lot of other cultures, there's no formal process for it. The law requires a certificate of divorce, which is unusual. Right? That's one point where the law of Moses is different from most of the cultures around Israel. That the law requires you to formalize the process with a certificate of divorce. But again, many ancient cultures did not require anything as formal as that. The act of leaving or sending away itself was sufficient for the divorce. And so Samson's father-in-law, and we'll hear him say this out loud later, Samson's father-in-law acts accordingly. At least as far as he's concerned, Samson has seemingly divorced his daughter. And so the father gives her away to one of the companions, to the guy who had been best man. We should add that this is very lucrative for the father of the bride, by the way. He can demand the bride price from this next guy as well. Now we're going to discover at the beginning of the next chapter that Samson does not understand himself to be divorced from the Timnite woman. And that's going to lead to the conflict at the beginning of the next chapter. So any questions or comments about the riddle game or anything? Go ahead. Yeah, he was not planning on losing this wager. So he goes and kills 30 strangers for these clothes. Yeah, he goes down to another city. All right, so the wedding feast is taking place in Timnah. He goes down to Ashkelon, which is another Philistine city. So that's what we read in verse 19. The Spirit of the Lord rushed on him. He went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town. So he just finds 30 strangers, kills them, which also, we probably ought to point this out, arguably this also is a violation of his Nazirite status, because when you read the Nazirite law in Numbers 6, being near a dead body, even if somebody just suddenly falls dead next to you, even if it's your father or your mother, the law says, it renders you unclean. It nullifies your Nazirite status. So, he kills these 30 strangers, takes their clothes, and gives them to the 30 companions back in Timnah. Saul?
So let's just assume Samson was obedient to God in his Nazirite vow.
Mm-hmm.
How would God have eliminated the Philistines through?
That's a good question. And I don't know, honestly, I don't know that I'd have a good answer to that, at least not off the top of my head. This is not the thing that I would make a big deal about. I think eating out of the lion's carcass is probably the biggest deal breaker. All right, so, good question. We've got enough time. Let's break into chapter 15. We're going to read the first 8 verses. After some days, at the time of wheat harvest, Samson went to visit his wife with a young goat. And he said, I will go in to my wife in the chamber. But her father would not allow him to go in. And her father said, I really thought that you utterly hated her. So I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please take her instead. And Samson said to them, this time I shall be innocent in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm. So Samson went and caught 300 foxes and took torches, and he turned them tail to tail and put a torch between each pair of tails. And when he had set fire to the torches, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and set fire to the stacked grain and the standing grain as well as the olive orchards. Then the Philistines said, who has done this? And they said, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion. And the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. And Samson said to them, if this is what you do, I swear I will be avenged on you, and after that I will quit. And he struck them hip and thigh with a great blow, and he went down and stayed in the cleft of the rock at Etam. All right, so Samson decides to go back for his wife. The language does not paint Samson in the best light here, because he says, I will go into my wife in the chamber. And he's brought a young goat with him as a gift, which, as I was studying this, the first thing that came to my mind, you know, bringing the young goat to the woman, what immediately came to mind was Judah in Genesis chapter 38. Remember that his daughter-in-law Tamar has had to disguise herself as a prostitute because Judah won't give her another husband out of his sons. So she disguises herself as a prostitute, and Judah comes to her, not realizing who she is, and seeks to hire her services. And remember the cost of that. He asks, "How much for me to come into you?" And her response is, "A young goat." Now, there's no connection drawn explicitly here between what Samson does and between what Judah does. I just thought that was evocative that he comes with the young goat, which at least in one point is the price of a prostitute. And he says, "I'll go into my wife in the chamber," which again seems to be that's his primary concern here. Not necessarily that he's... This doesn't read like he's being sweet and trying to make amends with his wife. It reads like, for lack of a better phrase, it reads like a booty call. Which should come to us as no surprise, because why did he pick this woman to be his wife in the first place? Because she was right in his eyes. Right? She looks good. But of course there's this problem that at the end of chapter 14, the Timnite woman's father married her off to another man because Samson left the wedding feast in a rage. And this is also fairly typical in antiquity, by the way. Most ancient law codes provide for, you know, what the father of the bride can do in the event of a wedding going south. So this Philistine father steps in and stops Samson from going in. Now, again, there's a lot that's debatable about this whole situation, but one thing that I think seems pretty clear is that even if Samson has a legitimate grievance against the Timnite, even that legitimate grievance would not justify Samson in doing what he does next, at least purely as a matter of dealing with the marriage problem. At best, he's entitled to some financial compensation. Instead, he goes out and he burns down the Philistines' entire crop. This is happening at the harvest time, so they're starting to bring in their harvest. They've got stacked grain that they're in the process of harvesting. There is still grain standing out in the fields. There are olive orchards, and Samson burns it all down. This is their entire livelihood. Now, why fire tied to foxes' tails? I mean, the fire part's plain enough, right? He's going to get his revenge by hitting the Philistines where it hurts, taking away their entire livelihood for that year. Why foxes? We're not told. Maybe he's got some flair for the theatric. But consider, what is the meaning of this? Right, as we've seen, as we've been talking about, that's a two-level question. There is a divine purpose to all of this that, again, we saw declared back in chapter 14, verse 4, that the Lord is seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. And so, in that way, Samson's actions here are part of that. The Lord is fulfilling his purpose by having the Philistines' crops burned down. Which, again, this is a dire situation for them. Because what does it mean to lose all of your crops at harvest time? Right? You're out of food. It's not even just a money thing. It's you don't have anything to eat. So there's that divine purpose. From the divine perspective, this is a blow struck against the Philistines in the process of delivering Israel. Now, We can ask here with this text, because we've suggested that, again, Samson himself may not be entirely with the program. We can ask here in this text, is there any indication that Samson himself is aware of what the Lord is doing through him? And if he's not aware, what seems to motivate him? If it's not, I'm working for the Lord, what's motivating Samson to do what he's doing? Yeah, it's revenge. Right? And he mentions that explicitly later on in the text. Right? After they kill his wife, he says, if this is what you'll do, I swear I will be avenged on you. We know in this context, at least, vengeance is a big part of his motive. All right, well, we're out of time, so we will continue this on Thursday. We should be able to get into Delilah on Thursday, so we'll hit some fun stuff. So thank you so much for your kind attention and your questions and comments. Let's go ahead and head outside ahead of worship.